Welcome, happy Palm Sunday, if you will. It feels like it snuck up on me this year because we've been talking about all the parables. We haven't been kind of preparing for Palm Sunday so much, but today is Palm Sunday. We celebrate worldwide the coming of Christ into the city of Jerusalem, and they enter him. They kind of embrace him as a king for a day, and it was a pretty special time. But frankly, it kind of got a little rocky after that. We've been talking about that. So we're in the middle of a series called It's No Joke. And so and it's really kind of aimed at next week, because next week not only is it Easter, but it's also April Fool's Day. We're trying to play off of that and to say, you know what? I mean, wouldn't it have been amazing, you know, for someone to come up and say on Easter Sunday, someone says, hey, he's risen from the dead, and maybe Martha or Mary come running into the room and all the disciples are like, hey, that's not funny. You know, that's not funny. You know, I know you're going to say April Fools, but that's not funny. And then they go, I'm not kidding. It's empty. And all of life changed that day. Everything changed. And so it's no joke. And we're going to talk more about that next week. But in this whole process of getting there, we're talking about the seven parables that are in the book of Matthew that Jesus told during what we call the Passion Week. So this coming week, all the parables that we've been talking about are the ones that Jesus told during that particular week. And you kind of expect, I don't know about you, but you know, you kind of think, okay, here's the last week of your life, or the last week before things are going to really kind of come to an end. And you'd either want to hibernate, it would seem to me, or maybe in our culture, maybe you'd say, well, let's just party. If it's going to be the end, let's just party. But Jesus said, no, you know what? I'm going to drive it home this week. I'm going to drive it home into the hearts of people. So he really takes this seriously. And so during this Passion Week, the last week of his life, he's going to tell all these parables. Now, parables are this. They're a simple story used to illustrate a moral or spiritual lesson. They're simple. They're designed to be pretty clear. So we don't want to make them too complicated. They do need to make sense. But we want to say there's a primary thing that's being communicated here. And in this, it is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. So Jesus was great at this. Jesus was an incredible teacher. He was very down to earth. He communicated right on the level of everybody there. It's really a story that has one primary point as its focus. That's what he's trying to get across, is something, one point. And you could almost say this, if they're used by Jesus to exact the cost of being intimate with him and his kingdom. He's trying to reveal these incredibly deep things in a very simple way. And he's used all of these parables to do it. Now, I'm not going to review all the parables, but last week, the parable that we had was the parable of the wedding banquet in Matthew 22, verses 1 through 14. And the point of this was that as an honoring faith realizes that the privilege of being intimate with God is supplied by the righteous covering that Christ provides for us, right? So in this wedding banquet, there were people who said, no, I'm just too busy, I can't come. There were others that said, yeah, I'm so angry at you, I'm not even going to come, I'm going to kill the people who invited me. And they did that. But then finally he said, go into all the, as far as you can go and invite everybody to the wedding. And so lots and lots and lots of people came. But one guy came without the right clothes on. In fact, it was the wedding garment was supplied by the guy throwing the wedding. And everyone, they were these beautiful garments. But this one guy said, no, I'm not wearing that. I'm going to do this on my own terms. Thanks, I'll do it my way. And they threw him out of the wedding into a place of darkness and gnashing of teeth. It's a very hellish description. Because he refused to wear the righteousness of Christ, he was going to wear his own righteousness. He says, I'll make it on my own, thank you. And Jesus says, that doesn't work that way. I supply the righteousness, because you don't have any of your own. Actually, the garments that we wear are tattered and torn and dirty. And he says, I'd like to exchange this broken place of your life with the righteousness that I'd like to give you. And so it's this wedding banquet where the righteous covering is what Christ provides for us. We can't do it for ourselves. So today, what I want to go on is to the next parable, but the next parable isn't until Matthew 25. And so in between the parable of the wedding banquet and this next one, which is another wedding setting, there's a bunch of things that Jesus says. In fact, 2.5 chapters of what Jesus was teaching during that time, and maybe it just helps us to prepare for this next parable, okay? So in Matthew 22, from 22, 1 through 14, where we were already, to where we're going in 25, these are the things that happened. Look at this, and I'm just going to go quickly, but it kind of helps us understand. Jesus begins to teach, and he says these things. In chapter 22, verses 15 to 22, he talks about how to handle the earthly versus our heavenly loyalties, because someone comes to him and says, hey, what about taxes to Caesar? Should we pay those? Because they're trying to get away out of it. And he says, very astutely, let me see your coin. Who's on there? It says, well, Caesar. He goes, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but give to God what is God's. And he kind of defeated these people who are trying to trip him up, if you will. Then in the next set of verses, the Sadducees question him concerning the resurrection. They come in and they want to talk to him about it. Now, you see, the Sadducees were Sadducee because they didn't believe in the resurrection. That's the only way I can remember it, right? And so they didn't believe in the resurrection. They believed in annihilation after death. And so they come and they begin to talk to him about the resurrection. And he tells them and talks about that. Then in verses 34 to 40, Jesus affirms the centrality of the great commandment. He says, really, the core thing here is that you love the Lord your God with all of your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's what he's saying, because a lawyer came and tried to trip him up. Because this was happening. All the religious leaders are trying to trip him up during this time. And so he says, he brings him back to the basics. Then in the next section of 22, Jesus is challenged concerning his identity over David. Because they're kind of saying, well, how can you be bigger than David and still be the Lord's Lord? And what's that? And they didn't understand that Jesus was going to sit on the throne of David, who was the king of all kings until Jesus came. And he's going to take over that. He right now sits on the throne in heaven. And when he returns, he's going to sit on the throne of David. And he's above David. And yet he comes after David. And they couldn't figure that out. And Jesus kind of sets them straight. Then in chapter 23, you guys ought to read it. It is a brutal chapter. There are these seven woes of the scribes and the Pharisees that Jesus commands. In each one of them, he calls them blind guides, you hypocrites. And he begins to call them out for their religiosity, but not their spiritual hearts. They have none. He says, you are whitewashed tombs. You are white on the outside and full of dead, ugly bones on the inside. And I'll tell you what, Jesus did not make any friends during this time. In fact, it was in the midst of this that they finally decide, find a way to arrest him and find a way to kill him. And they determined that they would. In the next part of 23, Jesus then sits on the Mount of Olives and he laments. His heart breaks over what he sees in Jerusalem. The city that was supposed to receive him as king, which they do today on Palm Sunday, but during the week began to reject him and plan to kill him, and he laments over their lack of embracing what God is doing. It's amazing. Then in verse 24, there is a prediction of the destruction of the temple. He's with his disciples, and he says, you see this incredible temple? Not one stone will be left on another. It comes true in the year 70 as the Romans destroy the temple. It's amazing. Then he explains to the disciples the signs of the end times. He says, I'm leaving, but I want you to know what's going to happen in the end times. I want you to know. And so he begins to describe it, of all those things. He describes the abomination of desolation, which is coming, which someday there will be someone who will set themselves up in the temple and call themselves God, and the entire world will begin to worship. It's going to happen. He describes then his second coming, and he's going to come in power and in glory. And he describes it to him. Then he reveals that the fig tree is an illustration. We've got our own fig tree going up here. He used it earlier that it had leaves but no fruit, and so he cursed it. Now he uses this as an illustration of saying, now that you see the leaves are coming, that means that the fruit is coming, that the end is near, as they began to produce leaves just at this time of the year. And incredibly, Beth got us a tree that was going to leaf out at exactly the right time. It was amazing what she did. And then, in the very last part, it was, no one, he says, but I'm coming back, but no one knows the hour or the day. So be ready. That's what he says. No one knows the hour or the day. And now he's going to tell a couple of parables that relate to that. But just so you know, let me just throw it up. Kind of his second coming. It's probably something we frankly don't talk about very much. In fact, we probably should talk about it so much more. Of all the events of human history, this is going to be unmatchable, the day that he returns. And for some of you, you think, well, I don't know. I don't know much about this. Let me give you just a small diagram up here, okay? So we have here on this diagram, on this line diagram, the church age over here to the left. Okay, that's the days that we live in. Someday, the Bible teaches us that we're going to come to a time of a 7 years of tribulation, where it's going to, all of human history is going to kind of come to a head, and there's going to be this time where the world is looking for peace. And there will be someone who will be raised up, who will look like a person of peace, and for 3.5 years create almost a world peace. And in the middle of that, he will then set himself up as God. He will set himself up in the temple, and he will be God, and there will be 3.5 years of incredible wrath. Because he's going to act as God, and he will begin to control the world as if he's God. There'll be these 7 years of tribulation. After that, then, is going to be a 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. 1,000 years on this earth he'll reign. And after that, there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. And so the second coming of Christ comes right here at the end of the tribulation. Well, he will return and take over, and he will reign on earth for 1,000 years. So the earth's not going to get blown up anytime soon. When Jesus returns, he's going to be king over the entire world for 1,000 years. And he's going to lock up Satan and all of his followers. And at the end of that 1,000 years, he's going to release them. And they're going to create one last rebellion. And he will then throw them into the lake of fire. And he'll create a whole new heaven and a whole new earth. It's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing what's going to happen. Now, you think, okay, one other thing I want to add in here. Is we talk about the rapture of the church. Now, depending on your perspective of the scriptures, it happens at one of three times. Either at the beginning of the tribulation, or at the middle part of the tribulation, or at the end of the tribulation. At the beginning, yeah. Let's take a vote, and maybe we'll send him what we decide. I particularly believe, though I wouldn't want to bet my firstborn child on it, I think it's going to be in the middle of the tribulation, because it says that for believers, they will not experience the wrath of God. And the wrath of God becomes to be unfolded in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. We escape that. I don't know if we escape the first part of it, of the tribulation. So I'm either a pre-trib, what they call pre-trib, or a mid-trib. I'm not a post-trib. But at the end of the day, all I know is he's coming back. Here's the deal. He's coming back. Now, you guys, if that's true, if that's really actually true, you and I live the closest to his return of anyone in history today. He's coming back. If that's true, shouldn't that capture us in some unique way? Now, there have been people predicting the coming of Christ for thousands of years, 2,000 years, and some people do kind of wacky things in getting prepared for it. My next-door neighbor in California at Y2K, he took all of his finances and he turned them into gold because he thought for sure Jesus was coming back on that day, turned it into gold, and hid it in his house. And really, frankly, he is a very well-meaning, lovely man. I didn't think his theology was right, but he was a lovely man. And so people have been doing all sorts of things, pulling out of society. When they think that Jesus is coming back. And frankly, he told us clearly, you don't know the hour of the day. All you know is there are going to be some evidence that line up to it. And someday it's going to happen. So be ready, no matter what. He's saying, live your life as if he's coming tomorrow, but plan and know that it may be longer. In fact, we're going to kind of see that here in this whole, in these parables. Now, really, a Christian ought to anticipate it with great excitement, the return of Christ. Probably the only people that ought not, who I kind of give a little bit of a leeway to, is the guy and a gal getting married next week. Like, I remember feeling that way when I was getting married. Like, Jesus, you can come back. Can you just wait a few more weeks? I just would like to get married. You know, I'd like to have this happen, okay? And I get it, right? But the reality is, the return of Christ is real. And he's talking about that as he's been teaching. And now we're going to jump in here. We're going to talk about the parable of the 10 virgins. Okay? So, I couldn't find a picture from the first century again, so I took a 21st century picture. And awesome enough, there were 10 bridesmaids in this one, 5 on each side. I loved it. This is a parable of the 10 virgins. Now, I don't really love the word virgins. You know, in our culture, that kind of goes, ooh, that feels weird, you know. So we'll kind of see what he was trying to say with this. But this is the parable of the 10 virgins. So let's jump right in and look at it. Here it is. It says this. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like this. So he's going to describe it. He wants them to know what's going on. The kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. So here's the deal. This is a whole wedding theme, right? Okay, so they're waiting for the bridegroom to come. So they've been engaged for almost a year. And now they're kind of preparing for the wedding ceremony, which is going to be several days long. And what happens is the bridegroom comes to get the bride and all of her entourage. And then he's going to take them back to his house. And they're going to throw about a 3 or 4 or 5 day party. Okay? And on the first night, it's going to be dancing. The second day, it's going to culminate with the wedding ceremony. And then there's going to be 3 or 4 more days of just absolute celebration. And so these bridesmaids are hanging out at the bride's house waiting for the bridegroom to come. And they're out there waiting for him. And then they're going to announce to all the rest of the entourage, hey, he's here. Let's roll, is really what they're going to say. Let's get after it. And so they're waiting for him. And so here are these 10 bridesmaids. Now, in that day, the bridesmaids were normally unmarried women, and that's why they called them virgins. And in that culture, to be a virgin before they were married would have been the norm. That was the expected norm. And so they use this because of its purity. There is this sense of purity of this wedding event and all of her friends who were the bridesmaids, who were the maidens, if you will. Though they do use, the Greek word is for virgin, who took their lamps and they went to meet the bridegroom. Now, here are them. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. So they had these lamps. They were pottery lamps, and there was a little wick inside of it, and they'd pour it full of oil, and they'd light that thing, and they'd be prepared. But you never know exactly how long it's going to last. And so in order for that to last, you know, I'm not knowing, you take extra oil with you so you could pour it into your lamp. But here, the foolish ones didn't take any extra oil. They just said, you know, got my lamp, light it up. We're not really prepared to know exactly how long it's going to take. But here it says in verse 4, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. Okay, so they're wise. Now look at here in verse 5. And the bridegroom was delayed. They all became drowsy and slept. The bridegroom somehow is delayed, as guys can be at times. And I think if we take this without trying to make too much of it, I don't know, we've anticipated the return of Christ for a long time. And in his own wisdom, in his own plan, it didn't happen overnight. It's been 2,000 years. A lot of the things that Jesus talked about that were going to happen haven't happened yet. Though some, frankly, they do feel like they're beginning to unfold. Maybe even with the beginning of the return of the nation of Israel in 1948, but unique things beginning to unfold. Is it around the corner? I don't know for sure, but I do know this. I ought to live the same way no matter what, is what he's saying. I ought to live the same way. But the bridegroom was delayed, and they all got sleepy, understandably. And they're not put down for that, but they got sleepy and they slept. But look at this. But at midnight, there was a cry. Here's the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Can you almost imagine? Like, they've been waiting so long, and it's cool, and like, here he comes with his whole group. And it's going to be beautiful, and he's going to come get his bride. This is like so much fun. Don't you wish it was kind of like that in our culture now? You know, literally, they're marching through the streets and they got their torches going, and there's this excitement and party. We're going to get the bride. Wow. And we're going to bring her back, and it's going to be an incredible party. Wow. Now, so it says, then all the virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. They made them right. They made sure it was ready, you know, a really good-looking lamp. Now, look at this. And the foolish said to the wise, hey, this took longer than we thought. and we didn't really have extra. You know, can you give us some of your oil? Because our lamps are starting to go out. You know, could you share with us? Now, that seems like a reasonable thing to ask, right? A very nice thing. Like, could you share? Be nice. Be sharing. You know, we teach our kids that. Share. You know, don't be selfish. But here in verse 9, it says this. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. If we share, there won't be enough. And really, it's not saying, I don't want to share with you. It's saying, you should have been prepared yourself. You're responsible. You're an adult. You need to be responsible for your own. So you need to go to the dealer and deal. They'd been irresponsible. They're saying you need to be responsible. When we see the Lord face to face, it will not be on the account of someone else. It's not their fault. I will face him face to face for me and no one else. It's just me. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast. And the door was shut. And afterward, the other virgins also came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open up. I mean, we just went to buy some oil. Yeah, we weren't prepared. We weren't ready. We didn't really anticipate it. We didn't really, frankly, care that much to be prepared. But now we understand the intensity of it. And so can you let us in now? Well, look at this in verse 12. But he answered and he said, truly I say to you, I do not know you. The wrap up here, verse 13. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. Be prepared. Be ready. There will be a day when it's too late. Because I wish it wasn't that way on one level, because I really want, I'm a pleaser, right? I want to be the nice guy. And I'll let everybody in at any time or whatever. But God's holiness requires that we be ready. And those who say, I don't really care, I'll do my own thing, he'll hold them responsible for that. That's a tough saying. This is what Jesus is saying. On the last week of his life, just a few days before Passover, a few days before he'll be executed, he's saying this, be prepared. Don't let it sneak up on you. You don't know the hour of the day, but be watching. Be ready. Wow. So I think what's going on here in the parable of the 10 virgins is this, is that our faith, go back to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, it says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. The bridegroom's not here yet, but he is coming. And we need to be hoping for that which we haven't seen. That's what faith is preparing for that. Especially the return of the Messiah, right? In fact, this next slide. Real faith means anticipating his return and being ready. Because you never know. And in this story, in a really tough way, there are five who were shut out. And there were five who were included. That's a tough saying. But that is what Jesus is teaching and talking about in his return. The people would be ready because it's really going to happen. Wow. Well, you know, Jesus follows that up with another parable that's critically important to us understanding what he's trying to say to us, is that while we are waiting and anticipating his return, he tells this story of the talent, the parable of the talents. Okay, now, talents, we usually think skills and abilities. But this term in the Greek is a talent, is a weight of measure of a precious metal. Gold, copper, usually of silver. So a talent was equal to about the weight of 6,000 denarii. Now 1 denarii is a day's wage, okay? So 6,000 denarii would be worth a lot of money. If you do the math, and you're making, let's say, 6,000 denarii would be somewhere short of 20 years worth of salary, okay? So 20 years worth of salary, let's say you're making 50 grand a year, this is gonna be just somewhere around $1 million. And this is gonna be the parable of the talents, each talent worth $1 million. Those are rough numbers. This is no small deal. Jesus is telling a big story here, okay? So here, let's get into it. The parable of the talents. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them with his property. The one who gave, and the one he gave five talents. That's $5 million. Wow. I mean, I think Jesus is making a big statement here. He's going to say, I'm going to entrust you with an incredible value. And so he gives it to them and entrusts it to them. The one, he gave five talents, to another, $2 million, and to another, one. He gave him $1 million. You think, well, I don't know, you know, what was that all about? But look at here, it says, and to each according to his ability. And then he went away. He knew the skill and ability, the responsibility, to you know, be able to manage things. To one, he gives $5 million, to one, two, and to one, one. You know, that's probably fair, right? He doesn't give the same level of responsibility to each and every one of us. He knows what he's wired us for. And he's given us all that we need. And he's invested it in us. And he says, here, use this. And none of it's cheap, right? It's not like he says, here's a nickel. You know, he goes, man, I'm going to give you $1 million. I'm going to give you $2 million. I'm going to give you $5 million. Woo! And then he went away. He entrusted it to them. Okay, verse 16. And he who received the five talents went at once and traded with them. And he made five talents more. So he took them, and the whole, when it said the Greek word for traded here, means that he went out and he worked with it. He invested it. He worked. He did all sorts of stuff. He invested in a Chick-fil-A franchise because it's a gold mine, right? I mean, that thing's a gold mine. Don't you wish you owned one of those? I do, because I go there all the time. I'm like own half of one already. But he went out and invested it in something of value. And he worked with it. He was responsible. He didn't just sit around. He did something with it. Excuse me. And as a result, he made five more. Wow. He's got $10 million in the bank as a result of all this. That's amazing. And look at verse 17. And so also, who had the two talents made two talents more. He did the same thing. Maybe it wasn't Chick-fil-A. Maybe it was a Taco Bell or something. I don't know. You know, he just invested a little lower. But look at verse 18. But he who had received the one talent, he went and dug in the ground and he hid his master's money. He just hid it. He did nothing with it. He covered it up and went about his life and did nothing of value, did nothing responsible with what God had invested in him. He did nothing. He just ignored it. Well, look at this in verse 19. Now, after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. He came back. I don't know how much later. Maybe he came back almost 20 years later. That's what the salary would have been like, 20 years worth of salary. And he comes back, and he's going to settle accounts. And so when he who had received the five talents came forward, and he said, bringing five talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me five talents, and here I've made five more. And the master, look at this, you guys, it's really incredible what he says. Well done. He confirms and affirms. Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. And here's the result. And I'll give you more. He who is faithful with little will be faithful with much. He who is unfaithful with little will be unfaithful with much. He proved himself, his faithfulness, to what God had invested in his life, what the landowner here. And I'll set you over much. And then look at this in verse, the end of 21. Enter into the joy of your master. It's not just that he was going to give him more. He said, I want you to experience my joy. I want you to experience this relationship of connection. I want you to have all the joy in me. I want to have it in you. Wow. Now look at verse 22, though. And he also who had the two talents came forward saying, and the response is the same, but Master, you delivered me two talents and I have made two talents more. And the master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. Now, let's get to the one, obviously. It's where the story's going. So in verse 24, he also who had received the one talent came forward saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid. I was afraid to fail. I was afraid that you'd be critical of me. I was afraid to do anything with this. I was totally afraid. And I'm not going to do anything. And so he went and hid your talent in the ground, and here, have what's yours. He brought it back, but he'd done nothing with it. He had not invested himself in what God had invested in him. And he gives it back. Now here's the response. This is hard. But his master answered him and said, "You wicked and slothful servant, you are so irresponsible. You did nothing with what I gave you. You knew that I reap where I had not sown, and you know that I gather where I scattered no seed. You knew that's what I require that you engage. Then you ought to have invested your money with a banker." I mean, if you're not going to go out and invest in Chick-fil-A, at least take it to the bank and make a couple of percentage points. You know, with no work whatsoever, right? You go to the bank, you put it in there, you put it just in your savings account, it makes a little bit of money, just a little bit. But you don't have to do any work, you just put it in there. Because at least you could have done that. But you didn't even do that. "And at my coming, I should have received what was mine with interest, at least a little bit of interest." He says, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10. If he's been faithful with a little, I'll give him more. "For to everyone who has will more be given, and he will have it in abundance. But from the one who has not, even that will be taken away." And then look at this. "And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. Into that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." If you choose to do life on your own account, if you take what God has given us and stuff it in the ground and do nothing with it, then we're saying, "I don't need you, and I will not respect you. I'll do life on my own terms, thank you." And he says, that's what you choose, to be separated from me. But to be separate from him is to be in a place of great pain. You guys, these are tough things that Jesus is saying. But as he is coming to the end of his ministry, he's driving us to really engage him. Here, the parable of the talents is about that faithful faith means investing yourself in his kingdom. Investing yourself in what he's all about. So I just have a couple of questions for you. I have really a couple of questions for me. And these are tough questions in terms of where we live, the day in which we live, and the place in which we live. We live in a very self-sufficient culture, especially West County, frankly. Things are pretty comfortable here. Our average income in a home in West County is not $50,000. It's more. The abilities that he's given us and the time that he's given us, we're going to invest it somewhere, right? We do, of course we do. We invest it somewhere and in something. And the question is, what is it? So let me just ask the first question. Do you anticipate Christ's return in a way that affects the way you live? Or have we been kind of lulled to sleep in all of this? Not anticipating it, kind of hoping it's way down the road somewhere, maybe, kind of, sort of. And maybe, hopefully, it doesn't affect the way we live, because that'll be for another generation. We can kind of just keep living the way we live and hope that we can maintain something until that we don't become a burden on society after our retirement and into the place where the last lap of life happens. Maybe it was just hope. Someday that won't happen for some generation. We just hope that it's not our generation. I think maybe we can maintain. But, and I don't think he means, hey, take all, you know, all that you own and give it away. Though, we'd have to take the example of the older woman who went to the temple, and all she had was 2 mina. They are the smallest coin in all of Roman and Jewish existence. It's all she had, two little coins. And she put them in. She had everything she had. Everything. I don't know if that's what he calls all of us to in every way, but are we willing to say, here's all I have. It's yours if you want to use it. Use it any way you want. And he might say, hey, I want you to invest in a Chick-fil-A. Give some people some employment and some really good chicken sandwiches. Or I don't know what it is. Maybe I want you to invest in some way to make a difference for good. Or maybe I want you to give it all. I don't know. But am I willing to put it with my hand open or is it closed? Do we anticipate Christ's return in a way that affects the way I live every day? If you knew he was coming back next week, what would you do? Well, I'll tell you this, I wouldn't mow my lawn. I mean, what a waste, right? I'm not mowing my lawn. If you're coming back next week, that thing can grow. I don't care. I'm going to do something more significant than mowing my lawn. Now, after a few weeks, my neighbor might get a little mad at me, so I need to mow it. But what would I do? Probably I'd want to gather my family and say, I love you. I probably would want to go to my neighbors and be less concerned about their rejection than I would about a love for them and tell them that Jesus is coming. Maybe I'd want to go, I don't know, but I hopefully wouldn't waste it. Do we live in a way that makes a difference of our anticipation of the return of Christ? Second question. In the meantime, prior to Christ's return, are you faithfully and wisely investing all that he has entrusted to you in a way that shines as a light in the darkness and brings flavor to the tasteless world? We all have a bunch of stuff, right? We have a lot of time. All of us have exactly the same amount of time. Exactly. Not 1 second difference. We all have the same amount of time. We don't all have the same amount of money. But I have what I have. He's given me what he's given me. And we don't have all the same amount of skills and abilities. He has gifted each one of us uniquely and different in all of that. And the question is, what are we doing with it? Really? It's interesting in our culture, especially where we live, our time seems more valuable than our money. Because life gets so full. But sometimes I don't have enough time to invest in that which is really important. And I'm probably invested in things that aren't that important with my time. I'll never forget several years ago, at the end of a service, I was talking to a gentleman, this is back in California, and he was 55, and he was talking to me, and he said, he goes, I'm just so tired. And I said, really, why? And he says, I was up all night. I said, really, what were you doing? And he said, I was playing video games. And I thought, wow, whoa, that might be something you do in college. That might be something you do in high school. Friday night, play video games all night. You know, I can understand that. At 55? Really? Really? He didn't have anything else of value in his life. You guys, what are we spending our time on? What are we giving our finances to? What about my skills and abilities? You guys, do we have it openly in our hand to say, God, use it as you want. You show me, you tell me, I'll obey you. I'll do what you call me to do. I'll go where you call me to go. And it might be scary, but it would probably be the biggest adventure of my whole life. What do you want me to do? I think that's what Jesus is saying. Hey, you guys, he's coming back. Be ready. But in the meantime, invest what he's given you in a way that makes a difference in the kingdom of God. Because there are people right now, who need to hear and know of the reality that Christ came for them. And he died on a cross for them. And he wanted to transform their lives change them from the inside out. He came for them. He has their name on his heart. And he dies for them. Same thing he did for me. And I didn't deserve it. Jesus is calling us, I think, to the same thing he was calling his disciples to. And it's a tough saying, right? I mean, it's hard. But this is what Jesus was all about. He came to comfort the afflicted. And he came to afflict the comfortable. And frankly, I can be so comfortable. He wants to call me to something bigger. Something about him. Make the world a place where his kindness and his grace is known deeply in the lives of people. So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to take just 30 seconds to a minute. I'd like you to mull this over. I'd like you to wrestle with it. I'd like you to pray. I'd like you to try to take the stiff arm that each of us feel a little bit when we hear Jesus' words and see if you can relax it a little bit and let it come closer and wrestle with these things. This is what Jesus was saying to his disciples, calling them to something bigger. See if you can kind of let down the guard and let down the resistance and say, God, whatever you want, it's yours. I'll obey you, whatever you call me to. Because you're coming back. And in the meantime, I want to invest the millions you have given me for your kingdom. All right, let's pray. Father, listen to each one of us as we wrestle with what your Son says to us.